Going to open the House Committee on Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities. Today we're going to have a wonderful topic. It's the annual, is it annual or biennial? Biennial State of Agriculture in Oregon report. And a briefing from the department. We've got lots of their board members who are here meeting as well. And then we're going to have a bill that has to do with the makeup of their board that we'll do after we probably spend about an hour on the presentation and questions with the board members. And with that, maybe Director Koba and the chair of the State Board of Ag, Ken Bailey, can join us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning.
Morning.
Thank you.
Okay.
My name is
Chair.
Good morning.
My name is Katie Koba, and I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and get that out of the way?
Yeah, I'm Ken Bailey. I'm the chair of the Board of Agriculture, Cherry Gore from the Dalles in Wasco County.
And we are delighted to be in front of you this morning. Thank you for also adjusting your schedule to accommodate when the State Board of Agriculture is in town. And so we are meeting beginning yesterday evening, all day today and tomorrow, and a lot of the members will be in the building this afternoon meeting with legislators. The State Board of Agriculture is a policy-making board. It's appointed by the governor and provides policy guidance to the State Department of Agriculture and really is kind of our first-hand touch in terms of eyes and ears about what's going on in agriculture around the state. Reflecting the diversity of the industry, our board is also very diverse. And in your report on page 5, you have a listing of the board members, and they are all behind me in the audience this morning. So we're delighted to have them here with us today.
Did you have a quorum? Should we not have them doing any business?
They can't do any business. Yeah, that's
right.
Correct.
Anyway, as long as you provide some oversight to assure us that we're not doing any.
Okay, Bernie, I see.
Yeah, you can look at the picture, match them up with the name, and then you'll know who they are. We're very excited about this report, and 2 years ago was the first time we released the first ever State of the Agriculture Industry report. It was the result of a change in legislation in 2003, which gave the board this charge. And so this is our second report to you. And for those of you who remember the report from 2 years ago, this one looks very, very different from that one.
I was going to say, this is smaller and it's black and white.
Black and white is a sign of the times. So I just wanted to kind of give you an overview about the structure of the report, talk a little bit about the industry overview section, and then I'm going to turn it over to Ken, and he can really talk about the key issues that the board chose to highlight this year, and you will notice that there are policy recommendations attached to each of those issues.
Wow.
I wanted to draw your attention to page 7 and the box, and I'm a numbers person, so I apologize because numbers really make me very excited. But I mentioned that Oregon agriculture is extremely diverse. Over 230 commodities that we produce in this state. We are equal in terms of variety of commodities to California or Florida. We are different in terms of quantity. And so we have to be extra special, and we are. But in the box, it really is a very nice illustration of that diversity. You are comparing three counties, Tillamook, Sherman, and Malheur, and you can go through the numbers. I'm not going to read them all, but just look at the number of farms in Tillamook, 333, Sherman, 210, Malheur, 1,272. And then you go on down, and you see the land percentage in farms. And then you see total net farm income from operations. Tillamook is second ahead of Sherman County, and that's really reflective of the higher intensity operations that we have in Tillamook, i.e. dairy farming, versus wheat production predominantly in Sherman County.
With a little more water, Sherman would do better?
A little more water would help Sherman a lot. The challenge is Sherman County is not irrigated. And trying to get irrigation up on some of those hills, and Ken can speak to that more succinctly than I can, would be a challenge even if we had the water. But water, as you will see in our issue list, is highlighted. The next page, page 8, is a thing that we do in all of our statistics. It highlights Oregon's top ag-producing counties. And the thing that I always point out, and this has been true since I have been director, if you will notice, four of the top five ag-producing counties in the state are in the Willamette Valley. Two of the five are in the Portland metro area. And a lot of people just don't realize that about agriculture in Oregon, the fact that it's not just a rural phenomenon, that it does happen in urban places in this state, hence leading to another one of our issues, land use.
Perhaps, and then, perhaps just for Representative Gilliam, you could say who the number one agricultural...
Representative Gilliam, number one agricultural producing county in the state, Marion County.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Gilliam.
I have Marion County, and I wouldn't let you have that one to yourself, you know.
And then on page 9, another thing that we do, Oregon's top 10 producing commodities. Greenhouse and nursery has been in the top slot for quite some time, followed, as you can see, grass seed, hay, cattle, calves, milk, wheat. All of these are usually in the perennial top 10, top 15. And a lot of the variance from year to year, obviously, is oftentimes due to the price of the commodity in that given year. It's not because we are seeing fluctuations necessarily in number of farms doing grass seed versus milk versus wheat, what have you. And then finally, on the right side of page 9, you can see where Oregon ranks number one in the nation in the production of commodities. A lot of our grass seed, blackberries, boysenberries, loganberries, hazelnuts, onions, Christmas trees, potted florist azaleas, and one of our board members grows potted florist azaleas. They're beautiful.
Oh, Marion Berry? We're not the number one producer? Or is it Andrew Blackberry?
Representative Roblin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Roblin, I don't know. I bet you it's lumped in with blackberries.
Okay.
I'm sure someone in the audience would be able to answer that question.
And Director Cover, your good friend there, sweet cherries is a category you're in mostly, isn't it?
Yes.
And I just want to know where you are personally in the nation.
In the nation, Oregon, I think Oregon is number 3 in sweet cherry production.
Yeah.
And in the state, the cherries are about 13th or something, 12th or 13th.
But Ken is being modest. Orchard View Farms, which is a family-owned operation, which is true for about 98% of agriculture in Oregon, family-owned and operated, is the number one sweet cherry producer in the nation.
That's what I thought.
And we're also the largest sweet cherry producer in Sherman County.
Yeah.
Although we've not produced any cherries in Sherman County yet, we just started planting orchards. We're in the process of finding out if it's a goable concern.
I noticed that River County didn't even make it into your list of where you're from, and you've got as many acres as I do right next to me.
That's just a part.
Oh, I know.
That's the hobby part of his operation.
I look at it enviously all the time.
So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn it over to Ken, and he can get into the meaty issues that we've got in our report for you this biennium.
Good morning, Chairman Clem and committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you this morning and present part of our report. As Katie mentioned, this is our second biennial report with the change in structure and responsibilities of the board. 2 years ago was the first one. The first report... Representative Roblin indicated, that it was much more technical, a lot more information, and we felt that was needed at that time. But then from carrying on, we wanted to get it to be a little more personal and get a little more condensed and get to the point on various things. And in our first report, we listed 20 different issue items that we felt were important to agriculture, and we picked 12 of those to highlight in this report. Maybe we can say that today those are the top 12 of the 20, but not saying that the others aren't still very important, but in order to keep the condensed version and get it to something that people would read, we would develop this format. I think it worked really good this time, and who knows what we're going to do for the next report in a couple of years. But each board member in this took a subject and wrote a personal introduction to that issue, and then it's followed with some explanation of the issue and some possible policy positions on that the board feels strongly on. The first issue the statement was developed by Director Koba, and highlighting sustainability in agriculture and how we fit into, you know, everybody is going sustainable, whatever that means to various people. But we like to highlight that agriculture is sustainable, has been, always has been. To highlight that, there's some indications in this report showing that there's was over 1,000 farms in Oregon that have been recognized as century farms that have been in business over 100 years. And this year we are recognizing those farms that have been in business for over 150. And the last number I've heard is 19, and I think that's the number that's in here, that have been qualified for that program. And I would challenge any other industry in Oregon to come close to those kind of numbers, that we've got businesses that have been in the same family for that many years and still active in Oregon.
Maybe Representative Krieger's operation.
Yeah. There's probably a few families who hit it, but I don't know if it's that volume.
Well, it's as a, from the personal standpoint, my family has been active, some members of my family in the Dallas area since 1870s or 80s. I don't know how, the exact number, but we got a century farm because it was one side of the family was there at one time, and we some moved around, and we're not operating the same piece of ground that we were. Or the family was years ago. The current operation is only 85 or 90 years old. So
only
we're trying to make it work. Maybe we'll get there. But the sustainability piece kind of alludes to the certifications and assurances that are found in agriculture today that we find that I think early on that agriculture was reluctant to go to some of this, but we're finding in the marketplace, you see with the peanut scare, the spinach and various other things, traceability, being able to certify what you have and isolate yourself from the rest is becoming almost an essential part of staying in business today.
So I've got a question for you, just out of curiosity. Do you, on your place, do the GAP standard? Are you from anybody familiar with it?
We've done the GAP standard. We've not kept it up because we moved on to some other things. We began with Food Alliance and the GAP. We continue this Food Alliance. We do have. We moved on to what was EuroGAP. This is now called Global GAP. Basically, a certification out of Europe. We've even gone to more advanced stage of that. Tesco, a major retailer in Europe, has their own standard. They were the major beginning of Europe GAP, but they established that so they could establish a specialty out of that, and in order to market through them, they were a different standard. So we have several different certifications that we're keeping up on today, and we have programs we have to go through, and many of growers in the state and processors have various types of certifications that they're doing today. But Global GAP is kind of one of them that is kind of showing up as the lead really around the world and spread from Europe to the United States, but actually is recognized more in Asia and Southern Hemisphere markets as well.
So Diamond Fruit Growers, a co-op we're part of, started growers just trying to move towards GAP. And I just want to know whether if this is accurate, because I have a hard time believing it. My cousin told me I couldn't let my dog out into the orchard anymore. When we pulled up, he said, no, he's going to have to stay in the car. And he can't come in the Capitol anymore. He's having a bad year.
Yeah,
there are some of those things, and those are real challenges of people expecting things that are in many cases unrealistic. Why should you keep your dog out of the orchard when wildlife are in there on a regular basis too? What's the difference? Maybe there are differences, but I think and how to police that and how to enforce those kind of regulations and monitoring and. As a matter of fact, you never know for sure how certifications are handled. You visit farms in foreign countries that have got the same certification that you have, and they appear to be doing things that you could never get away with doing to get certified, and so you wonder. But you also see plants in other countries that they're doing things that you hope you never have to really do. So it's all over the board. But the biggest part of it, I think, is the traceabilities and the assurances of what you have done, not necessarily trying to dictate what has to be done, but documenting what you have done so you can prove you have or have not complied with something, or you have or have not used certain chemicals or so forth.
Well, I like policy recommendation one. I know that the day he told me I couldn't bring OG out in the orchard anymore, I would have picked up the phone and called somebody and asked them at the OSARC if it existed. So we could end the debate, because it went on then for about an hour and a half. I was on my phone trying to Google GAP to prove that no OG could get out of the car today. And so I took him back to the house, and he stayed in the house all day, which was, he was not happy.
You know, not to beleaguer the point, but, you know, there's some rules and regulations you tend to want to ignore. Not that you're supposed to.
You all, and you said you want to. Doesn't mean you do. You just
nobody here ever exceeded the speed limit or that sort of thing.
God forbid.
On the highways and whatever. But and, you know, who says that? Some people claim that legislature makes unreasonable rules once in a while. But, that's a whole other subject, maybe.
Not in this committee.
Moving on to the next subject, protecting crops and animals. Doug Kramer, one of our board members, is a blueberry grower here in various counties in the Willamette Valley, did the opening statement on this. And crop control protection products are important to the industry, and people also need to understand even organic has uses pesticides, or they may be organic or natural, whatever you want to call them, but they all must be considered what they are. They're all pesticide or fertilizer chemicals, and we need to make sure that we all understand how those are used, and again, back to the traceability and documentation of using and the proper use of chemicals is very important to the industry. Next one, again, is a, you know, all of these tend to, if you want to talk about them as individuals, or you could almost say all of them are the top one, agricultural labor. Tom Fesler, as Katie indicated, is azalea grower and other crops in the Mount Angel Woodburn area, did the opening comments on that one. Some interesting stats on this page as well. That upper right-hand corner, page 15, shows the table on total dollars of the industry and of the state. And its bottom line shows agriculture is a little over 10.5% of the dollar values of industries in the state. And employment-wise, over 140,000 jobs, full-time or part-time, in, directly to agriculture, and then you add wholesale, transportation, and other numbers, retail associations with agriculture, you get that number up to over 200,000 jobs connected to agriculture. So labor is an important part of agriculture. We have issues with immigration policy, certification, again, of the viability of labor, eligibility of labor, what their statuses are, and what I know the state doesn't have any direct control over that, but some states have tried to exert that control, and I think that's been probably a mistake, but that's another debate for another time maybe, but the federal government needs to some way determine how to deal with immigration and labor supply issues. It's very difficult in times of high unemployment or increasing unemployment as we've got today, but there are certain people to do certain jobs and certain qualifications. I think more and more agriculture is coming into where maybe historically people have thought of most agriculture jobs as being low skill. In reality, even down to the harvest labor is not really a non-skilled job. Not just anybody can go out there and make a living at the types of jobs that are required in agriculture, and we're doing more training and so forth. A lot of things in agriculture labor are changing over time, and we need help sometimes, and one of the biggest issues is with the escalating labor costs in Oregon compared to other states is a major issue. The indexing of the minimum wage is a major issue. That this probably won't be the last time you hear those sort of comments. The next issue...
Just on that point for a moment, if most growers are anything like our orchard, you don't pay minimum wage very often, but when minimum wage goes up, everybody gets usually that same exact boost. So that's why it's... Like
well,
in
not
our cherries, we had one worker made, one employee, $37 an hour picking cherries this year.
Yeah.
So nowhere close, but... everybody else during pruning time and other things, if they were 50 cents or a dollar above, it just automatically goes up, whatever it is. It's not just the minimum wage usually.
Yeah, and you indicated cherry harvest. Our harvest the last couple of years, because of new training systems and whatever, we've developed a new larger cherries that the pickers can pick faster. The pickers are making good money. We employ families, and there are workers that are making near minimum wage. Our crew average is almost twice minimum wage. And we've had several workers that are averaging over $30 an hour for nearly a 60-day season.
Oh, wow.
And that's not too bad.
Yep.
And it has allowed us to attract a lot of good workers and keep them, and I think in some ways an advantage over some other segments of agriculture that may not be able to afford to pay those extra dollars. But we pay on a piece rate basis, so we can justify it by that. But if you had to do that on a straight hourly basis, your productivity go down, and there's no way you could afford that sort of thing.
Same for us. Yeah. Thanks.
The next major item is water. Bob Levy from the Hermiston area wrote the introduction to this piece. Again, I could say almost every one of these is a really top issue, but I think long term, water, I like to think labor is one of the most important issues, but long-term water policy from the state and federal is going to have a huge impact in the continuation of agriculture. The availability of water, who has control of the water, we see in many, many areas that municipalities and other government agencies of some sort are acquiring water rights. This water is still being used in agriculture, but when the need comes, that water may be withdrawn and directed to the cities. And when that happens, how do we maintain production of agriculture without water? And that's basically impossible. Certainly we can, and we have a lot, done better jobs of developing new systems, more efficient water use, and so forth, but you can only carry that so far, and then you start looking to, well, are we bringing food in from somewhere else that's got water, bringing it from outside the state at least, and probably outside the country if you're going to replace the production that we need. Oregon, again, it goes back to the statistics, though, is, Oregon is not just producing food for Oregon. In fact, 80% of what we produce in agriculture today leaves the state, and 40% of that leaves the country. And that's bringing new dollars back to the state, so it's increasing the importance of agriculture to the state of Oregon by bringing new dollars back to the state and providing jobs and everything else. But water is going to be major issues. We need to find ways to conserve the water we have. Oregon is known for a lot of water, but it's just at the wrong place at the wrong time, and we need to find out ways to make that get the water to where we need it at the right time.
And I might just draw your attention to the statistics. Irrigated agriculture in Oregon is very important, and you can see that in the statistic box. Oregon ranks third in all states in the number of farms that use irrigation and ninth in the total acres that are irrigated. But I think the most telling statistic is the last one. Irrigated farms in Oregon produce 77% of the total value of all harvested crops. We just can't overemphasize enough this issue and our concerns with potential impacts due to climate change as well.
Yeah, I was just going to ask also and point out, I think we have gotten much better in our irrigation products and in the use of water. However, that has an impact on groundwater. Our groundwater has a problem, and part of the solution to that had been, in the past, our irrigation practices that allowed water to get in to the ground. And now we're using it more efficiently, but we're not solving another problem, which is getting water back into the ground. So.
And in the water rights issue, it gets complicated in that if a given farmers, most of them don't use their full water right all the time, but they know it's there kind of as a cushion and whatever. So, okay, well, eventually if you sell some of that off to a municipality or whatever, that almost guarantees the use of that water, and it doesn't stay in the system to be used by anybody else. But so one farmer upstream, if he sells his water right and somebody else picks it up and uses it, then when that upstream farmer is not using it, a lower down in the stream, farmer is expecting that water to get down to him. But if somebody buys that water up right up and uses it, then it's not in the stream for the guy down the road. And so it's a big system. It's complicated and a lot of controversy involved. And you know, there was some pretty good fights on this over the past of the developing of the West. But I think it that could be minor compared to what's going to happen in the future if we don't do some prior planning on water and water availability and conservation.
I know Representative Schaffer would like to talk about water a little bit.
Hey, I apologize for being late, Mr. Chair. I was in another meeting, and my time got carried away with me. You know, I hope our agriculture is sustainable, and those of us who enjoy eating better hope it always remains sustainable, because then we're going to have a real problem on our hands. And I don't think anybody does a better job than here in Oregon. I'm going to jump back a couple of issues. Federal government definitely needs to step up on immigration. We can do all kinds of things here in Oregon, but you know, and as far as the folks that come here to work, you know, I mean, I grew up working in the fields of Iowa along next to my neighbors and friends, and the first qualification you need to get a job out there is the willingness and the ability to work. And God bless all those, wherever they're from, for being willing and able to do it. On the water, and a lot of people that whine the loudest about this couldn't do that work. On their best day, they couldn't do that work. So anyway, I don't care what color they are, where they're from. On the water, you know, I was blessed with the opportunity to be on the Water Committee in 2003 with Bob Jensen as chair, and got an incredible education and have continued that ever since, and I've been all over the state. But you folks out there east of here are world leaders in the efficient use of this water and the technological innovations you've brought about. It's incredible how miserly you use that water and effective you are with it. I just wanted to point that out. And we have the resources in this state to create thousands of jobs up there. And I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. Matter of fact, I learned it from you and people just like you. And we're just sitting on our hands doing nothing, and it's criminal. And there's people in this building getting in the way of it. And this economic time is just criminal for us to prevent the use of that resource out there. And we have the tools and the know-how and an army of people out there to know what to do with it right now, today. And those communities out there can use that revenue to provide services that this state cannot provide. I just cannot hammer that loud enough and often enough. And I want American food grown in Oregon. I don't want stuff from Chile and Argentina and China. God bless all those countries and all those people. I want my food coming from here. And I think everybody who's listening to this, and 3.7 million Americans live in the state, agree with that. So you got my vote. Thank you.
Clarify your position.
Yeah. So two things. One, I'm afraid the Capitol Press is going to leave now that he's got all his sound bites for the day. luckily, there's a couple more topics. Two, we're going to get some really great bills here about barriers to, for example, Multnomah County wants to be able to purchase Oregon-grown agricultural products for some of the food that they give out to, you know, or you know, in the prisons or other services. They can't do it because of a state statute with their own tax dollars. Can't put a preference in for Oregon because of an Oregon statute. So we're going to get the chance to fix that.
Good.
Farm to school, it costs a lot of money. We got to make our arguments that it's just as strong as any other economic development sort of program that's out there, but we'll get a chance to make our argument on that too. And I'm looking forward to your responses on land use here in a second, because we're about to go through that, and I'm not sure you're going to be on the same side of these guys.
All I know, Mr. Chair, is farmers use gravel too. I'll leave that.
Yeah, that does lead into our next subject. And by half a chance, I was picked to write the introduction piece on land.
I think you chose land use.
I noticed that. We're going to be nicer than the Big Look Review Land Use Committee, I promise you.
Oh, that's fine. I've had no problem with listening to criticism of what we've done, or because it's come from all sides, and that's not a problem. But land use, you go back to looking at all the other topics, especially water. Well, if you don't have the land, why do you need the water? And so it land and water, I think one of the main pieces that we need to consider on that is we can't keep one without the other. We have to coordinate how we use land and how we use water. We can't deal with one in isolation from the other, and that includes a lot of these other subjects too. But the land and the water, you need to have enough land, water to do what you need to do on the land, and if you don't have the land, I guess you don't need to worry about it. But you worry about where your food's coming from is the issue. But there's a lot happening on land use. We just feel that it's very important to protect the viability of agriculture and uses allowed on ag lands can be a conflict with what a viable operation can do. The increased costs can, especially in tight times, and when we're always having to cut down to increase our margins, or create a margin of profit, that we need to eliminate all the costs we can, and added burdens. It gives incentives for people to decide that they don't want to put up with it anymore and go do something else, or give them incentive to sell out and get to have the land developed or something else. And I don't think. I think long term, the best economic piece use of good ag land is for agriculture. In the short term, it's been shown that sometimes somebody could sell this piece of ground for something else and make a short term profit. But I think long term, for the society and for the government, and more economic gain can come from that, keeping it in agriculture.
Just for committee members' information, I am not certain that it's going to come here, but if you're interested in the issue of the exclusive farm use zone and what's allowed and what isn't. I have a bill I spent with folks 60 or 70 hours going through every part of the statute that has to do with the EFU and looking at what things right now are you know, in there that maybe shouldn't be, in my opinion at least, what things are in there that get allowed outright that maybe need some more analysis before you just say yes, it could be done. You look at alternatives. It's long, it's complicated, it ranges from parks to schools to gravel to whatever. So I haven't dropped it because I'm still trying to perfect it. It's a complicated subject, but if folks are interested in it, there'll be an opportunity to weigh in on that issue as well. Representative Robles.
I think one of the things that this book, hopefully other people look at it, will really point out, going to this page and the very first ones that we were introduced to, about which counties produce the greatest value. And sadly, the conflict is right there in this page, because the places that are the top three producers are the same ones that are being encroached on by our biggest municipal areas. And again, if you look at it, and I go back to water a lot, one of the resources that they do have here oftentimes, more than the east side, is water. We know that irrigated land in the east can produce a whole lot more than it currently does when unirrigated. So having some conversations so that people truly understand the relationships of these different things and how valuable the land is when it has the ability to produce, I think maybe that conversation will help everybody understand what we need to do and how we have to do it. This is a really great. I thought last year's book was wonderful. I use it all the time because it has all the stats that I would ever want to have. But this, so far, I'll look for the rest, is really a totally different approach, which I think is exceedingly helpful.
And I assume you've got a dry wheat sibling, Director Kova, who likes to talk about water when you try and have family get-togethers.
That's right, exactly.
It's been well-trained by Mr. Levy, I think. Mr. Chair, I might just add in terms of land use issues, and now I completely lost my train of thought what I was going to say, but in particular on the now I remember on the what we hear from, and the department gets complaints, and more we receive complaints from people who have moved into the country. They love the lifestyle, they love the green in spring, but they don't like smell, they don't like noise, they don't like the use of pesticides. And this is a huge problem for the industry, and it reflects in what we're trying to do in terms of land use, because it truly does impinge on producers' ability to operate.
If the newer members haven't heard my story about the gentleman who was renting somebody else, a grower's house out in the middle of an orchard, screaming at me for being on the tractor at 7 a.m. and kicking up dust. And you know, I then asked his landlord at some point, how much are you charging that guy? He said, like $160 a month just to keep it in there. And then he got busted for selling pot later, too, which tells me something, and evicted. But, you know, he decided to spend quite a bit of time railing on me about the rudeness of harvesting, basically.
I think all of our members could tell personal stories about land use issues. One of my favorites is this woman asked her next-door nursery neighbor to please hold off on doing any work in their nursery until she could complete her morning walk with her dog through their nursery. It's true.
Through their nursery.
True story. Through their nursery.
Mr. Chair,
that's gap violation.
I was just going to say that that person should have also informed her that stray dogs would be shot on sight.
But it brings up the subject also that this protection from conflicting uses also goes to the more rural parts of the state as well. And in the big look process, the hearing we had in Burns, the ranchers there were about as strong as I've seen from other places, and it's just recently they've kind of been a lot more vocal, but they have trouble with the conflict, and they're not talking about the one-acre piece coming in, but they have problems with 160-acre pieces being the odd lot. Out there on the rangeland, they need long, large acres, and the value per acre is pretty low, but in order to get the viable operation, they need a lot of, but they can't spend a lot of money per acre to protect that. And when somebody moves in next door, the cost of invasive species, weed control, and dogs and whatever, and fences and so forth that they are forced to put up because of somebody in their neighborhood is extremely expensive to their operation, and maybe much more so than some of us in the more urban settings. And so those controls are just as important out there in those very rural areas as it is in the urban fringes.
Excellent.
Mr. Chair, maybe we should do a quick time check. I'm not sure how long the committee has.
We were going to go another 20 minutes or so on the report before we did the bell.
And I will take three board members with me a little bit before 9 because we've got some legislator meetings, but we'll leave the rest of the board and Ken and Lisa, who,
as long as you
will
want
know,
it.
Does
oh,
a
yeah.
much better job than I do anyway. So.
No. Well, no offense, Lisa.
Yes.
We're ready to go on to the next subject. We're
yeah.
Land
cool.
use at another time, another place.
Well, this is non-controversial.
Yeah, non-controversial. Come back into the next item of food safety. Dan Carver from out in the Bay Coven area, southern Wasco County, cattleman and sheep, and doing a lot of innovative things on direct marketing of some of the extensive type of ag land, which is the type of thing that is bringing a lot of value back into that part of the industry. But there again, the traceabilities, the certifications and so forth, food safety, just keeping everything identifiable and so forth is extremely important, and the branding and so forth helps in the food safety issues as well because of knowing more about where you're at. But food safety issues, we've talked about the peanut problems, the spinach, and other things that have happened, how widespread those things can be if we don't keep control of that. And we need to, and it's becoming a problem with the state with the department in that with some of these things happening, if something comes up, we need to be in a position from the department to respond quickly to get things under control, and with the less staff, it's maybe down the road and less ability to get out and catch things in the bud could cause major costs down the road that could be foreseen if we keeping the agency in a proper position in the short term. But the food safety issues are extremely important.
So before we leave this one, did I read some article recently about something going on with country of origin labeling? Is it a court challenge to it, or?
Mr. Chair, there's and the USDA has agreed to review the rules that were adopted, I believe, even in January. The issue surrounds specifically meat and meat production, and I think beef producers in the U.S. feel the rules are too lenient, and there are ways that you can bring in meat from Canada or Mexico, mix it in the production process, and still label it origin of U.S. And so I know that they threatened to sue. I don't know if they have. I think they're waiting to see what comes out of the revisiting of the rule.
Do we have challenges the other side from countries and, you know, within the WTO or something over?
Well, Mr. Chair, certainly I think Canada has been the most vocal in their concern about country of origin labeling, and particularly for cattle producers in Montana, northern Idaho, even in Washington. There's a lot of movement back and forth over the border when you winter or summer your animals, and the concern that if you spend some time with your animal in Canada, you can no longer label it U.S. country of origin, and some real concerns from Canada. That's the biggest one that I've heard, and I don't know if you've heard anything else, Ken.
Senator Shaw, briefly.
Yeah, I had the great privilege of working in a packing plant my second year in college at night, lugging beef. And when you really think, just to put a little perspective on this, and by the way, I enjoyed listening to Congressman Walden's activity in committee yesterday. It was just incredible, and I give him all the credit in the world for being so on the ball there. But, you know, when you put this in perspective, all the hundreds of millions of people we feed and the volume of food that comes out of this continent, it's amazing how few examples of anything wrong happening. When you really look at the totality of it all, it's incredible. So, and with very little resources, I might add. And I think that gets lost on. I'm not minimizing what's going on, but believe me, my daughter eats peanut butter and meat, and that would be devastating if anything happened to her for me, as it is all these other families. So I don't want to minimize that, but boy, you put it in a little perspective, and it's incredible the job we do, and there's improvement. But
well, it's fascinating amazing. To me, those of us that have traveled to Mexico, you just know when you go there, you need to be careful about what you eat and if you drink the water or not. And the thought doesn't even cross your mind in the U.S.
Yep.
Yeah, and I think we do have to recognize that, yes, we do have maybe, I don't know if by far, but we do have the safest food supply in the world, probably. We can all feel terrible about people dying from a food-carried disease or problem, but at the same time, the perspective on it is such that we do need to do what we can to minimize the risks, but at the same time, we can't. It's a mind-boggling to see how, like in the tomato bit here not too long ago, that the tomatoes took such a great hit, but by the time they got done, they figured out, well, it really wasn't the tomatoes,
yeah.
It was the peppers or something else. And the industry, even on the spinach, they label it directly to the spinach, sure, but even regions that were not in production at the time of the outbreak and all this, they were hampered and were prevented from selling their product because of the way we handle it. I think we've got to recognize that there are very serious issues, but we need to determine a better way to handle them and keep them under control and control them without devastating a whole industry because of something we don't know. We need to know more, and that gets back to how we handle food safety, how we do certifications and traceabilities and so forth. We need to do a better job of that so we can minimize the effect on the innocent producer that is producing a good quality product of the same product that has gotten somebody else in trouble. And being able to isolate and identify branding or whatever method you use to identify your product and is differential from somebody else, and that helps divide it to where you don't have to include the whole industry when you've got a recall.
Mm. And you know, for countries who don't like the country of origin labeling system, the alternative is far more severe, which is we'll just go back to heavy tariffs and banning their access, period. So it's you know, there's only a couple options in this regard.
Well, those things go both ways too. So
yeah,
you got to consider, especially when we talk about Oregon needing to ship 80% of what we produce out of state. We need to be conscious of the fact that
trade wars.
Trade is a big issue for us. Next item we have on our list of production costs. This is more general. Jan Kearns from Baker County cattle and potatoes grower is a lead on this piece. I don't know how much more I need to go into it. Just we all know that production costs have gone up, and maybe at times prices go up, but right now prices are going down, and where the twain meet, we don't know. But production costs increase, we've always got to be considered of what state does and regulation and whatever, how that affects the production costs, all these certification things and all these things will continue to add costs as well.
And
Mr. Robo.
Yeah, and I think in this one that it isn't stated right here, is also processing. We're losing our processing capacity in our state, and that makes it harder. Production and costs go up because you got to get it to wherever you're going to process it.
Right. Yeah. Our processes go away, and so it makes it a necessity to change crops.
That's true. So.
A part of the same thing, going on to the next subject, Steve Van Morwick introduces this transportation section. This is the ability of it, security of transportation, as well as costs and so forth of fuels and other things makes transportation a major issue. Infrastructure, roads are important. How much time your farm truck has to spend on the road as well, to deliver your product, caught up in traffic can make extra costs involved and everything else. But transportation, not only local but international and so forth, is a major concern to many products out of Oregon. Next subject, local foods. Lynn Youngbar, she's a public member of the board. She's not a producer, but she works with been working with mostly farmers market area stuff, and so she's got some connections. Local foods has become a major new emphasis. As we point out, that most of Oregon agriculture is shipped out of state, so it's not the biggest segment of agriculture, but it's also a very important segment. But I think it's one that has helped us bring the issue of agriculture and importance of agriculture to the urban areas and the people that have not recognized it as much in the past, that how important it can be to get higher quality food and actually get a better return to some of the local farmers by cutting out some of the extra handlers in the middle, that the profit can flow more back to the grower by keeping and marketing locally.
You know, this to prove how helpful these documents are, I arrived at the Capitol thinking I had this great idea called Farm to School. I met with Director Kobach. She's like, yeah, we already had that in our budget option package. It didn't make it past the first leg of review. And so if you want to just take all of our language and run with it, great. So I introduced the bill. Well, then I read back, like in 2002, they had it in their sustainability on agriculture report. So not particularly a new idea, but if I just read the book, it'd get great ideas for many programs and bills that we should have been doing apparently several years ago. But just a confession slash suggestion for bill ideas for members.
And that's the same thing on a lot of these subjects. There's maybe some good ideas and whatever, and we'd like to keep them up on top of the table if we still think they're viable, because at times you don't fund them because of the lack of funds, and not that they aren't a good idea, and we recognize that, but we need to, I think, somewhere down the road determine how much we want to spend. If these are really good ideas, maybe they need to move up the funding priority list. So.
Representative Shoffler. And you know, Mr. Chair, on that vein right there, I am so grateful. I grew up in a small town, and my dad moved us out into the country when I was in eighth grade. But, just a thimble full of common sense spreads a long way. And I don't think there's anyone with more common sense than the American farmer or rancher or timber owner, because they're innovative on their own. They're self-reliant. They take care of their own, and they make their own living. And it's somehow, when you come into town, it's somehow that's all just lost. And not just in ag, in all the issues we deal with here. But I just had to throw that in there. The ideas out there have been going around for hundreds of years, and it's lost on us in this building. And it just, boggles my mind. So I'll shut up.
Before we ennoble the all the growers too much, we spend a lot of time alone on our tractors too, and sometimes we have a conspiracy theory or two that we sit there and dream of that may or may not be true. FYI.
Yeah. Very good. I've got two or three more subjects that we've got issued here. We want to introduce the family farm transition is one of the another major area. You may or may not know that actually the average age of farmers in Oregon is increasing almost by the number of years. I think in the last the last census this was taken the USDA of 2007. It showed a four-year increase in 5 years of the average age of farms. So it's kind of a striking number, and the number of really young farmers under 25 is almost minuscule, and we're looking to help find ways that we can more transition and invite and even non-farm individuals that are capable to move into farming. And as the more we can find ways to do that, I think the sustainability of farming is going to need more young people coming in.
Yeah, I believe that's excellent. Representative Erwin.
There's a number of us that would like to see the tradition in the Shuffler family continue.
Yeah.
He moved his family out. And
On that, Mr. Chair, if I may, when you go up into my office, there's an aerial photograph of a dairy farm in Minnesota where my dad grew up. And I spent many happy days there fishing on the lake right across the road. But that farm, three generations of Schaufflers have farmed. They no longer do dairy. It just, you know, you talk about the margins and the expense and the cost, and they just... there's a sad story goes along with all that too, but I think that farm is definitely threatened. I think my cousin down the road will end up taking it over, but I'm, in case my aunt and uncle are watching, I don't know anything about that. But he actually farming it, and I don't. That's exactly what they're just getting squeezed out. I have hog farmer friends I grew up with. They can't find anywhere to sell their hogs because they're not big enough. And they're just getting squeezed out for one reason or another. Some blame corporate farming, some blame cost, labor, whatever, family devastation. But it is a real issue. And I have a question here. How are you, because of the initial cost of buying a farm and getting involved, and you just can't go out and be a farmer, I don't think.
No.
So how are you getting young people back into this field?
There are some programs out there. You go through, take classes at Oregon State or some of the community colleges and whatever, but a part of it has to do with just the farmers themselves need to recognize that this process needs to happen and start bringing in others maybe to work with them and train them on the farm, and be it family members, or if they don't have family members interested in that, or bringing in somebody else to help take over the farm. There's an effort being started. We had a conference yesterday at Oregon State talking about how to do this, and a lot of good ideas were thrown around there, and an effort is being made to try to come up with a program to help encourage and set up systems to have young farmers have access to farms, land, have access to capital, have access to the technology they need and the education, and how to try to set up a program to be more directly working on that, rather than just rely on right with what we have now. There are things out there, but you have to go looking for them, make them more available and more organized, and maybe be more successful.
Sure. And yep, Representative Krieger.
Last year we passed an inheritance tax that was designed to help natural resource people, and in my district, I know of several that basically had to sell the farm because they didn't have an estate set up properly with a trust or something.
Yeah.
And so I think anything that we can do to continue, and we do have some legislation coming again to kind of fine-tune that bill, and you're part of that.
Yeah.
And we intend to try to get that through and have leadership understand the importance of being able to pass those lands on down through the family and not in the middle of a transition take a huge hit financially. We need to also promote that at the federal level.
And I think there's a lot of things that can be done at a planning level. We just need to educate farmers as well that you don't wait to the last minute, because some of the best plans take many years to implement. And so you want to start 10 or 15 years before you're possibly going to want to transition, actually, you need to start building that, and you can find ways that you don't need to worry about the inheritance tax if you've done proper planning. So there's a lot of angles to it, but it's an important thing that we put more emphasis on, too.
And colleagues, you know, I'll share with you my personal stories at some point, but it's a very serious issue. Not and there's a lot of elements. There's tax consequences. There's just the ability to make an income without off-farm income, and then understanding how you can try and bridge those gaps, because it's not easy. I mean, I originally thought we were just going to run the orchard. I quit my job. I moved up there. Carol, we were getting ready to sell the house, and she was going to move up there, and then we just had a horrible pear price year that year, and so I was like, well, what else can I do now? So I started my computer business so I could essentially work for free in order to help her dad and learn, because you need many years, when you didn't grow up there, many years to follow them around, ask questions. You know, I didn't go to school for horticulture. And then luckily a cousin has stepped up to help a lot, but that gets into planning issues, which is, did you leave people who participate in the farm equal percentages, and then the family start duking it out over ownership, and you got, you know, if you just enroll in the Austin Family Business Program, they talk about all that. So there's some good stuff here, but it's tough. Other states have whole programs devoted to this. The one thing I've noticed naturally, at least in the Hood River Valley, I think it's a cycle, it's a trend. Carol's folks, or grandparents, immigrated from Japan. And they were farm workers. Eventually, they were farm owners. You're starting to see more of that, former farm workers getting involved in buying orchards. And that's where a lot of it, historically, I think, has happened. So, you know, now Carol's family, they're almost at 100 years. In a few years, we'll be at 100 years. But, you know, there's a next generation of farm workers who are becoming owners, too. And I assume that's probably all over the place.
It's happening, but it could be more.
Oh, yeah, and you have to help facilitate it, too, because there's all kinds of cultural barriers
it takes
back
time.
Then and now. Yeah. Sorry.
We're running out of time, probably. Yeah. The next issue was climate change, and that's another subject you could probably talk on forever, but at the same time, which one that agriculture has recognized that we need to deal with. There are those that are skeptical that anything's happening, of course, but at the same time, they all recognize that there are issues out there, things are changing, and things are changing if you like it or not, and you better figure out a way to deal with it. And agriculture wants to be at the table to make sure that what policies and so forth are there. There's also the advantages that agriculture can take advantage of, providing open space for whatever purposes to help in the climate change issues, be it carbon sequestration or other things, or at least preventing, again, back to land use issues, preventing development keeps more open space. There's all kinds of balances that we looked at to deal with climate change types of issues. The final issue that we've got on it, in fact, I didn't mention that the climate change introduction was done by Pat Dudley. She's a great wine producer just in the West Salem area. The energy piece, this is another one done by Tom Fesler, and energy is important to agriculture. We use a lot of energy in the way of fuel and so forth to produce our crops, but we're also looking now, if there's some farmers in eastern Oregon especially, putting up or allowing wind turbines on their farms to help generate income as a side piece. Solar is another aspect, and actually we're growing crops for energy production and ethanol or biodiesels and various other things, and looking into the future of what, be it crop residues or waste or straight crops grown for energy production in various forms. So that's a major issue as well.
Mr. Chair, may I?
Representative Chaffer, yes.
You know, jump back here to the climate change. We talked that there was some folks from forestry industry in here the other day, and I think the number was 50% of the carbon that's sequestered in the state is sequestered in the forest. And I'm against this cap and trade business the way it's being presented today in this building. But if we're going to start handing out these credits, let's make sure the people that are actually doing the sequestering get those credits,
right?
Not some sheik from Dubai or some rich guy from China or Enron. But that's another story. But so that's one thing. On the energy, you know, I find it increasingly, it's just mind-boggling that people from town or who move from town out the country are the first ones to complain and whine about a wind turbine going up in their picture window of their McMansion. In Iowa, where I grew up, I went home 2 years ago to bury my dad, and these wind farms had just sprouted up all through central Iowa. And those farmers, we talk about outside income keeping people on the land. That is exactly what's kept some families on the land, and they are, and God bless every one of them. And that's the kind of thing I want to see, and I want to see the people out there that know how to run this land stay on that land. And if this energy idea keeps them on that land, that's a good thing, and it's carbon-free energy. It's just you live out that way. I don't know where you're at, and maybe I've offended you, but the fact that that first wind just threw in the towel and left this state because of some folks complaining is beyond me. So I'll just leave it at that.
I mean, you've offended me 8 to 10 times, and then and then I've loved everything you said for another half an hour straight. So I'm sure that's what Ken's in the same spot.
And I love the chair's dog, too,
yeah,
by the way.
Very good.
I own two dogs myself.
Representative Robland.
You know, this is this booklet and the relationship between the Board of Agriculture and the Department of Agriculture are things that are exceedingly, I think, wonderful about our Oregon's way about doing business. And the stark difference between the Board of Forestry and the Board of Agriculture has just always been amazing to me. And it took me a long time, my first couple of times, to realize that they were really totally differently organized. You are strictly an advisory board, and we get a lot of great advice because so many of the people on the board, as you've pointed out, because of all these pictures, have direct relationships with the industry. And it is a great opportunity to have the ear of people who are going to be helping put in these policies, who then have a better understanding. And I think, for me, this board has been a really wonderful thing to have the opportunity to work with over the last couple of sessions. And these books are another example of why it's so good. So thank you for your service.
Well, thank you. I think that points out one of the differences between the Board of Forestry and the Board of Agriculture. The Board of Forestry is a regulatory board. It has regulatory authority, and the ag industry had the opportunity to ask for that if they wanted to. The industry looked at that very carefully and I think wisely decided that the industry wanted to have an advisory board made up mostly of producers. We have 8 producers, and we have 2 producers that are 2 members that are not producers, and that's, we're going to clean up a bit of that with supposedly with the language in the bill you're going to be talking about. But if you go to regulatory board, it's almost incumbent that you have less than a majority to be producers, and that's where the forestry board went to, and so it's a whole different function, and we still respect and support strongly the regulatory functions of the department, but we as a board don't get directly involved in that. But we by policy and whatever, we can maybe help set up some of the ways that is done, but the authority for regulation does not flow through the board, and therefore we are more of a outreach for the industry, a contact for the department directly to the industry and so forth, rather than being just an arm of the agency dictating back and form a regulation to the industry, which is a whole different light than what most of us wanted to do. The cooperation has been great, and I think we've gotten more benefit with the type of structure we have. There's one other person I'd like to recognize. I think he's still in the room. Bill Bogus, interim dean of the Oregon State College of Ag Sciences. Bill is an ex-officio member. The dean is an ex-officio member of this board, and Bill is the interim dean filling that position at the present time, and is one of the candidates for the permanent position going through interviews at the present time. And he did not. I guess we could have asked him to present one of these, but we felt he was busy enough with some of the things he had to keep going the director and the board regular board members are the ones that produce this document. And that's all I really have, and I very much appreciate the time you've given to receiving this report.
Thank you.
further questions? I think, Representative Robin, your last comment, whether you knew it or not, was a subconscious reminder that that's sort of the topic of the next bill, and I'm 10 minutes past 9 o'clock, and we should get to it. But thank you very much. I mean, this literally is a to-do list for this committee over the next couple months to go through these recommendations, see which things we can enhance and help get some traction on, and which things we have to be wary of letting get traction in the defensive mode because they're threats to the health of the viability of agriculture. So with that, now are we going to have different folks come up on our bill? Or is Ken staying?
Okay.
If you'd like to. Lisa, why don't you join us? I need to open a public hearing on House Bill 2210. Do you want to give us a brief summary of the bill, and then we'll let Lisa take over?
House Bill 2210 changes the membership of the Board of Agriculture. Currently, there is a requirement that two of the nine board members not be actively engaged in production of agricultural commodities. The other seven are required to be engaged in that endeavor, and this would remove the requirement that two not be.
Assistant Director, how are you doing? Is that the right title? Deputy Director, what are you?
Deputy Director.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So for the record, I'm Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Thank you for the opportunity to visit with you again about another one of our agency bills. Chair Bailey did a very nice job of segueing for me into House Bill 2210. House Bill 2210 attempts to modify language in the current Board of Agricultural statute. By way of background, I've provided you previous statutory language that referenced the two public or consumer members of the board to help you. In 2005, the Board of Ag proposed legislation, which was adopted, to modify the role of the State Board of Agriculture and give them more of a policymaking role within the Department of Agriculture. When those statutory changes were made, the language around the public or consumer representative was changed. As we have worked with the statute over the last couple of years, this is somewhat troublesome for us because generally people who want to serve on the Board of Ag, even in the consumer or public rep positions, have some ties or some interest in agriculture, not necessarily being a producer, but they may work in some of those intermediate processor. We have a public member that's involved with the Oregon, with the Portland Farmers Markets. Currently, one of our board members is involved in an export hay company. Previously, one of our board members, his brother was involved in grass seed production. This bill simply proposes to eliminate that section of the law that says who are not actively involved in agriculture. So it doesn't artificially limit those people who could qualify to be the public or consumer reps on our board.
Any initial questions, Representative Shuffler?
Only to comment that anyone who eats is actively involved. So, and may I add on to that, Mr. Chair, that these appointments can become very political, and I hope whoever the governor is appointing anything appoints people that are interested in the viability of agriculture and not hostile to agriculture. I would just add that as a bit of advice. But other than that, I don't have much to say, Mr. Chair.
Representative Roman, just one sec. I think at some point language is designed because there had been a thought across the board that, especially if you're going to talk about regulations, that industries and the public interest is somehow different. And that couldn't be less true in this regard. It still leaves the statutory language. It says two board members to be representatives of the public interest. What it doesn't do is predefine that if you're somehow actively involved in the agricultural industry, you can't represent the public interest. And the governor and the Senate will do those investigations. But, I mean, the first time I met a Bailey was, your brother was a chair of the State Board of Higher Ed, wasn't he, for a number of years? And so growers all over Oregon are engaged in topics outside of their professional activities for the betterment of Oregon. But to lose their service in the Board of Agriculture, when we have a check and balance system with the Senate and the governor to look at all those things, was an unintentional, probably, but misguided outcome, I'm certain. Representative Roblin, then Krieger, then.
Yeah, and I want to make the point that last session, Representative Clem worked with a group of people on school-to-farm-to-school things. And I think one of the things he found out very quickly, and a lot of other people did, that they weren't speaking the same language. They both wanted the same thing, but they hadn't had the opportunity to have the conversations. And watching the board work and having people that represent things like the farmer's market, farm-to-school, it could be a school person who actually wants to be in that, all of a sudden opens up that dialogue that allows people to realize that the words they choose make a difference, but the actuality, what the outcome they wanted, was the same. So once they got past the language, and that happens in places like the Board of Agriculture. So I would hope that these changes allow different groups of people, some of those urban people that Representative Shuffler alluded to earlier, start having those conversations, be on that board, start to really understand what is happening out there, have an opportunity to go visit in some of those places they hadn't seen before, makes all of Oregon a better place. So for me, this is the right kind of changes that will hopefully continue to broaden all Oregon's respect and understanding for each other. So thanks.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Most of the boards in Oregon do their work through the adoption of administrative rules to change policy. How does the Board of Ag then do that? I mean, if they're not involved in voting, who makes the decisions at the, you know, and how do you adopt those into administrative rule or statute? What do you do?
Chair Clem, Representative Krieger. The director of the Department of Agriculture has the rulemaking authority for our agency. And so we adhere to the public policies around rulemaking in terms of setting up advisory committees and follow the rulemaking process with public hearings, et cetera, as well as many things that have to do with policy and direction and rulemaking. We consult with our board on those issues along the way prior to implementation and the director adopting them. But ultimately, in ODA, the director has the authority to adopt rules.
Follow-up?
Yeah, well, those years I spent on the Board of Forestry, what I've seen happen since that time, in the Board of Forestry, there's seven up, not more than two can have an interest in forestry. So in my opinion, you got five ignorant people. They haven't lived it. They haven't been. They haven't cut a tree down. They haven't planted a tree, and too often they bring a environmental agenda. And I wish we could just turn that around. Similar to what you've got here. Originally, I think there were 12 on that board, and they all came from industry. And of course, that's what caused the problem, is because it was the good old boys upstairs, and they made policy. And along came the Forest Practices Act, and obviously a need for some change. But I can see where this policy or this practice would not allow as much of the political agenda of any particular individual to come in and be represented by a special interest group to gain power to promote that through that that process. And got to be careful we don't let that happen here, too.
Amen. Well, does anybody have any additional questions? We have no public comment on this bill. If not, I'm going to close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2210.
Thank you.
I'd like to move House Bill 2210 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
We didn't have to have a fiscal rescind.
I can mention it.
Was there one rescinded? That was the question.
No, there's no condition.
So there was not, no subsequent recommendation. Okay. Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2210 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Governor, right now.
Any further discussion? One moment. We're in discussion. The question is, do we want to have an amended motion for consent calendar, or maybe Representative Roblin would like to make the point he actually made to our colleagues? What are your thoughts?
It's one that could easily go on a consent calendar. If we think that it would be worthwhile to have a conversation and for the whole people to hear, whatever you want to do. It's fine with me.
It expedites the process. It's non-controversial.
Let's not make it controversial.
Yeah.
Okay, let's if you'd be so kind, then
amend it to be on the consent counter would be fine.
Representative Krieger moves the House Bill 2210 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation and it be placed on the consent calendar. Any discussion on that topic or that motion? Thank you. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Winger.
Aye.
Representative Shoffman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Van Orman.
Excused.
Representative Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Gilliam.
Excused.
And
aye.
Amen. Chair Klein.
Chair votes aye. I'm sorry, I'll get better at this, but
please
motion
don't.
Passes.
More amusing than
someday you'll have a gavel that you'll have that I'll be. I don't know if I'll be around to pay, but motion passes. I don't have to say anything else. I don't think. With that, that's all of our agenda for today.
I was hoping that if we stalled just a little while, Representative Gilliam might make it sit here, and request that we have unanimous consent to let him vote. But he's not going to be here, so I'm...
He's busy doing the people's work, I'm sure.
He is doing the people's work.
All right. I'm going to close our meeting for the day. Thank you.